You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 158 of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
Hello!
Hello, you're wearing your old Puget Sound Basketball League t-shirt.
You know it. You know
it. Jersey, I should say. No, let me not sell that short as a t-shirt.
PSBL.
From our team that didn't win a game.
Hey, we came close the one time you weren't there.
What about the time that you got kicked out for like a quarter due to a flagrant foul? And got a lot of
I got like penalty boxed.
You basically did. It was very confusing.
Something that didn't exist in.
Let me tell you, my single best stretch of that season came after you got put in the penalty box.
Wow, my best game came when you weren't there.
That sounds about right, doesn't it?
We're like
real energy among the Fabulous Pelton brothers, which is why it's a good thing we don't record a podcast together or anything.
And you know what we're like?
What's that?
The Curry brothers.
Oh, are we?
Who will be showing down this week in the Western Conference Finals. And we have a lot of toast to get to. And the beer that we have today from our good friends at Rogue Brewing Company, really, I think, technically based in, like, Eugene, Oregon. But
it's not Eugene. It's on the coast.
Based somewhere in Oregon.
If only there was some way to look this up.
But with a brew house in Portland, Oregon. And what you have here is the Rogue 7 Hop IPA. Alcohol content 7.77. And you know what I'm calling that?
What's that?
Is the Rogue Game 7 Hop IPA.
I mean,
for Portland's Game 7 victory in Denver, in your face.
In the neutral's face. They are headquartered in Newport, Oregon, for the record.
All right. Shouts to Newport.
And yes, obviously, that's why I got the 7-Hop IPA to pay tribute to that Game 7 victory. So crack that bad boy open. As you mentioned, we do have some toast to get to here.
I'm going all Portland because my side beer, the sour beer that I'm drinking, also is from Widmer Brewing Company in Portland, Oregon.
There you go. Have we ever been to Newport, Oregon? I don't think we've ever gotten that far south on the coach. On the coast is what I was looking for there. Coast.
We were riding the coach down south.
You know what movie I was looking up to quote it last week on Twitter was Kindergarten Cop, which is all set on the Oregon coast, like in the Lincoln Beach and Cannon Beach area. So I had forgotten that was part of the appeal of Kindergarten Cop, although I like have a distinct memory of going with our grandparents to watch that movie in the theaters.
You thought the only appeal was that it was classic cinema?
That was mostly the line, it's not a tumor.
Well, a couple of things to toast to here.
I mean, first the Blazers.
Are you sure you want to do that?
Look, congrats to them. It was a great performance in Game 7.
Mm.
What does that taste like?
It tastes like victory. It tastes like... I'm smelling it. Blazers in 5.
Oh, wow. We'll get to that in a bit.
That's in the finals.
You know what it tells me? You know what it tastes to me like? It tastes like Evan Turner scoring more points in Game 7 than the entire postseason combined.
I like the taste of that.
Oh, man, what a weird game that was. All right, next up, a toast to UW softball.
Here we go.
Which earned a share of the Pac-12 championship for the fourth time in school history, having previously done so in 1996, 2000, and 2010, going on to win the NCAA championship, the Women's College World Series, in the latter of those 3 years.
Now, how did they not? Because this team has been consistently good since 2010, right?
I mean, the Pac-12 is really good at softball.
It is wild.
And it took a pretty unlikely outcome for the Huskies to share this conference title, but we'll get to that later on when we talk UW softball. And then lastly, a toast to third Pelton brother Michael Sawyer on the birth of his child.
There we go.
Congrats.
You've got 8 to 10 more to go, Michael, Michael Sawyer. That tastes like victory for the Tidy Totems. I don't know what.
Just life.
Some sort of thing where getting the worst possible score counts as victory.
Okay. That's it for Toast. Should we talk about the Blazers?
Are you sure you want to do that? So we learned a hard truth during this basketball game. I don't know if you're willing to admit this. Oh, God. Let it be known that I'm already making you angry. We haven't even gotten to talk about the Sonics yet, or to the arena yet. And I'm... That's usually the section that you get most consternated in. We learned a hard truth during this game. I didn't realize that you're neutral, right? So I knew that we weren't on the same team. But what I learned throughout the game was that your neutral might have been leaning a little bit in the opposite direction. And that we found out that you were maybe had a preference, let's say, for the Nuggets' victory here, which was shocking to me, especially the way that I found out, because you weren't being open about it as a neutral. Everybody saw on Instagram your NBA hoodie.
Shockingly comfortable, that just NBA hoodie. I just want to note that for the record.
You're really a big fan of the association.
I liked Infrared's comment on that I was rooting for the refs because it reminded me of the episode of Saved by the Bell, the college years, where Screech is rooting for the refs and Bob Golic is consternated by that by that position.
Back when he was the most famous Golic brother.
Yeah. We're a member of the Golic family entirely. I mean, I feel like Mike Golic Jr. has passed him up now. He's out there doing draft shows with Mina Kimes.
The way that I found out that you weren't cheering for the Blazers was there was a run in the second quarter where the Nuggets were sort of, they had a lead and were sort of giving away that lead. The Blazers went a little bit of run, kind of going toward halftime. And
a crucial run.
What you were talking about in that run, you're like, they're giving up the game. You're like, the Nuggets are going to lose this game because of this. And then in the third quarter, I think the Blazers got hot and you're like, the game's over. What does it even matter? And I was like, oh, if he was cheering for Portland, he would not say these words.
No, of course not.
Because I kept being over there being like, this game is so far from over. And then I thought that they were going to lose and I was going to lose it on you. I was so prepared. I already blamed you for games that you weren't even doing that. But now that you were doing this, saying that the game was over before it was, that is the worst thing that can be done as a fan of the team. So you were trying to jinx it.
But it was accurate. Like, it was also coming from a place of knowing that if you're Denver and the Blazers have started the game, what, 1 of 20 from three? I believe they missed 19 of their first 23s.
I thought they were only 1 of 17.
Or they did. Yeah, they didn't actually shoot that. Or... I don't know.
CJ had one that clanked in.
However many it was. Anyways, and the Nuggets are still not leading the game at that point? Like, that's not happening then.
Well, they were leading the game.
Were they at that point? I think maybe the Blazers had come all the way back.
I mean, they went into the half up 9, I believe, right?
Yes. And it should have been 15.
I mean, the game could have ended. Game 7 could have ended in the second quarter. And that's what I thought was going to happen. I mean, watching it, I was saying the same things that you were saying, but from the negative perspective. Whereas, like,
this... Well, they were both from the negative perspective.
They were just from Blazers' negative perspective. Yes. Of where you never talk about your team playing well, right? This is just obviously common sports etiquette.
I mean, I do feel like it's not actually common sports etiquette. I think we're in the minority on this one.
Really?
Yeah, because most people want to talk about before games like great bravado about their teams.
Yeah.
That's why people
don't listen. New York Jets fans, what are we talking about here?
I feel like there's many Seahawks fans and Seahawks podcasts that are like that. And that's why people don't listen to this podcast. This podcast strictly for the pessimists.
Podcast. I feel like you sound like we're not subtweeting Beast Mode, for the record.
I love Beast Mode, but the 12-3-1 is a very different approach than we take.
It's like a joke. It's like a joke thing, though.
Yes, not everyone is in on the joke.
Wow.
Anyway. I mean, in terms of their Seahawks optimists, I mean, other people
all right,
are
fine. Serious. The way that we would react, and I feel like most sensible sports fans, is if your team is playing well.
I just don't want to say they're not sensible to be optimistic about your team. That's just like. It's like a form of loss aversion. Like if you expect that the team is going to win and then they lose, it's much worse than if you expect the team is going to lose and then they lose.
I've got
because
both
the pessimist
of those,
is either right or pleasantly surprised.
Because I've talked about this before that I always have the shred of hope no matter what.
Yes.
Until the very end, just like I cannot give up the shred of hope until it's over.
I mean, to me, the most salient recent memory of that is Game 5 of Portland, Oklahoma City when the Thunder went up in the fourth quarter. And it was like, you know, maybe the Blazers could still come back from this. There's still a chance.
Yeah. I mean, you're not turning it off, right?
Yeah.
But
hope is a bad thing. Maybe the worst of all things.
We totally agree on
and
this.
No bad thing
you
ever
have to,
dies.
But you have to, outwardly, you have to hide your hope, is what I'm
obviously
saying. If your team is playing well, there's a lot of time left in the game.
Oh,
and
so
if your
much
team
time.
Is playing
too
badly,
much time.
The game is over in the very minute that it is.
Yes.
Right?
This is basically describing our G-Chat conversations. With
even,
the famous
even if
cousin
that
Katie.
Minute is the very first minute of a UW-Oregon State game on like a Thursday in February.
Well, in that case, it definitely is over.
The game was over before it even started.
Inevitably, one of the Thompsons is going to make a game-winning three.
But so I found out this information and was personally shocked. I felt like the Blazers had done you no wrong, have supported you throughout the season, even as a neutral. They welcomed your people.
Your people being the media here, for the record.
Neutrals. To Portland, they plied you with free beer after the game, t-shirts, anything you could possibly want. It also means
lovely charcuterie board, by all accounts.
There's a charcuterie board?
There is. By all accounts, the food at the Pepsi Center is not very good.
I have to angrily take off my jacket and throw it on the ground.
He's literally doing this. It's not really very effective for the listener.
People got the sense. That's why I described it beforehand. Now I'm just in basketball jersey. We are ready to go. Just in case a game seven breaks out right here on this podcast. You're cheering for the Nuggets. Beyond all of this, all of these things, you didn't want Portland to win that game. Or can you not admit it publicly? Well, you can't because you were cheering for you had a slight preference for one team over the other, right?
I mean, often in life, I tend to find myself cheering for my picks. In this case, Denver was. But a
you're
bigger
like the
factor.
The person who cheers for their fantasy team over their like actual team.
But the Blazers aren't my actual team.
Go
I
say
am one. A neutral. What's important to note here, though, is that a big factor in this is that some people who were Blazers fans, and I can't think of anyone in particular.
God, he's obnoxious.
We're talking a lot of shit about Nikola Jokic.
Zach, why did you do that?
An unacceptable level of shit about Nikola Jokic. And really turning this into an us versus them thing, when both the Nuggets and Blazers, what they have accomplished this season, should be appreciated and celebrated. I sound like Bill Walton now. Like, this shouldn't have been... And I was unhappy with that over the course of the series. Like, I hate this idea that, oh, every playoff series that has to be enmity that builds up between the teams. Like, why is that necessary? Both teams can respect each other and still have a good competitive game.
God, spoken like a true neutral.
Exactly. I mean, are we expecting Seth and Steph to start hating each other over the course of this series?
Not every player has to start hating each other, but I think it's very common in a competitive playoff series.
But there was just so much back and forth about the, who flipped off the other team first?
Somebody like, flipped somebody off?
Michael Porter flipped off some Blazers
Thomas
players
the third.
In the game one, and then
Michael Porter's
Evan
out here flipping? Are you
Evan
kidding
Evan Turner did it after game six? I don't know. It was,
well, Evan Turner, he...
Middle finger gate,
he,
bird gate.
He walked the walk. Michael Porter, play a game in college. He played one game in college.
He's trying. Right? He's trying, Jennifer. That's been clear to play, by the way. Hey,
wait, really?
Might play in summer league.
Really?
Well, he's obviously not going to play a game right now. They don't have any schedule.
No, they
don't. I
don't
know if you're aware of this.
No, they do not.
Might play in summer league, though. That would be exciting.
It's natural as a competitor to know that you're playing a close, tough series. That's what happens. That enmity builds up when there's so much consternation that happens during a playoff series. It's a normal thing.
So if I feel like I had more Denver fans in my life who were complaining about the Blazers, I would have had the same reaction.
Besides
but
Isaiah
instead,
Thomas and Sue Bird and Michael Porter.
But instead,
and
all
Bob
I had,
Weiss.
I didn't have a lot of conversations with those people. And what I'm saying is, like, if you were rooting for the Nuggets and saying the same things about the Blazers, it probably would have pushed me in the other direction. I was just going to rebel against whatever it was you were saying.
So you're saying a vote for the Nuggets was a vote against me and Katie.
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
I personally voted for Robin.
Much like 17% of the MVP pool.
Okay, so Now that that is all over, you reap the benefits of being able to go to a Western Conference Finals game.
Although, this last week on this very podcast, you talked about how great it was for me to get to go to the live show in Chicago.
Oh, and I said that you were welcome.
Saturday night, opposite Game 3 of the series, which I will therefore not be attending. So, thanks.
That really turned around quick.
Yeah, it really did.
It became a sarcastic thanks.
I will not say that. I mean, there was an element of, you asked about that, there was an element of like regretting not being able to go there. Like, that's like the smallest amount of how I was feeling.
You're like, you can't make it to the party, therefore you want the party to be canceled.
Exactly. Yeah. If I can't go, then no one should get the party.
Take that, city of Portland.
A very mature attitude.
Kevin Pelton's not going to be there.
I mean, what's the point of even playing a Blazers playoff game?
Games.
I think they won both the games I missed back in 2014 because we were in Austin during the Rockets Blazers first round series that the Blazers ended up winning. Game six with the Dame Lillard shot was the only one game in that series.
That's weird because I was not even that big of a Blazers fan then.
It's true. You is a lifelong Blazers fan since 2018.
Yeah, I feel like that's about the timeline.
Yeah. Okay.
There were some Brandon Roy years in there, but. He wasn't on that team in 2011, was he?
In 2014?
Well, the year that they had the Parsons shot.
No, he was not.
That was 14.
Yeah.
Okay, so most importantly, it was a well-fought series.
Both
teams played hard. Close games. We had a lot of fun, right? And that's really what sport is all about.
Okay, yeah. That sounds like something a neutral would say.
So moving on to I'm just speaking your parlance. moving on to the next series. While we know that both teams will compete very hard, one team unfortunately has to come out on top. And do you think that the Blazers have any chance of being that team that comes out on top?
I mean, they have some chance. We did a 5-on-5 for ESPN about this series. That's going to be going up Tuesday morning before game one. And one of the questions is, if the Blazers won this series, how did they do it? And my answer to that was, well, I think they have to steal one of the first two games down in the Bay at Oracle with Kevin Durant very unlikely to play. He's out for game one, very unlikely to play in game two, and not even necessarily likely to play after that. But they have to take one of those two games. And I think that you know, a combination of, again, Durant not creating the matchup problem that he is and the Warriors kind of taking them lightly after finishing off the Rockets.
So you think that the Warriors, they saw the Rockets as that was their championship or whatever, at least their Western
Conference.
I mean,
you look at the way that Steve Kerr dealt with that series, starting the Hamptons 5 from game one, really extending
when
the minutes.
When did it become the Hamptons 5?
Well, they needed a new lineup because it can't be the death lineup if Harrison Barnes isn't part of it.
That's like...
So if you...
What is the dude for the... Andre Robertson, being the linchpin. Once Andre Robertson's back next year, watch out!
But it's not quite the same lineup.
Harrison Barnes isn't there, so it can't be the death lineup.
It's not quite the same lineup.
They only have Kevin Durant instead.
So I think there was...
That's where they went to recruit Kevin Durant. That's why it's called the Hamptons 5.
I mean, a few other names were proposed in the early days. I think the Death Star lineup
I've only heard of this,
out there.
This year.
No, it's been around a while.
The Hamptons lineup, I feel like it's really taken hold this year.
I would agree with that.
Okay.
So... Why would I bring up the Hamptons 5?
Unclear.
I've lost my train of thought.
No, you're talking about how Steve Kerr was taking that series seriously.
Yeah, I mean, like, and Durant was playing 45 minutes a game in that series. Like, they were really going all out to win that series, I think with an eye towards the fact that whoever they faced in the Western Conference Finals might not present as much of a challenge as the Rockets.
So do you think that... That has to be to the Blazers' benefit, right?
Yes, although the irony is because of the fact that the Warriors were able to close out in Game 6 without Durant, they got two extra days of rest now.
The biggest question that remains with the Warriors, right, is always their level of competition, right? Their level of interest.
I mean, their biggest opponent is their own complacency. That's what we saw against the Clippers, for sure.
So we want... As somebody who would wants a close matchup, but would prefer the Blazers to advance to the NBA Finals,
I'm just
and somebody who might say that the spirit of '79 is alive in Portland,
The spirit of the Sonics championship is alive. The spirit of 77.
77 is alive in Portland. Maybe the spirit of 79 also. Because can we get a toast? You might not do this. You might pass on this toast. To the Portland Trailblazers for doing something that the Sonics were never able to do. And that is avenge their first round loss.
Oh, I hadn't thought of that. They never played the Nuggets again, did they? Yeah.
And they'll never be able to again.
Someday. I mean, long after we're dead, but, you know, someday.
Portland, in these first two rounds, I think they might be undefeated when I've worn Sonics clothes the day that they're playing games. In these first two rounds, beat the Oklahoma City Thunder.
It's
going to
be really weird if you wear a Durant jersey now.
A Durant Sonics jersey?
Yeah.
Wow. 4D chess. And then, I don't really know exactly how. But
no, me neither. But usually when people use the expression 3D or 4D chess, they probably don't know how either.
And then going back and avenging the Sonics' loss to the Denver Nuggets. And the only thing that we can hope for, the only thing that we can hope for in this series is somebody needs to dunk on.
Who's the modern equivalent of Elton Lister?
I think Draymond might be Elton Lister.
No, first off, that is wildly disrespectful to Draymond.
Andrew Bogut?
Yeah.
If Dame throws it down on Andrew Bogut, he's got to do the pose.
Yeah. It's a bummer that would definitely be a technical, though.
It's worth it.
Which Warriors player do you think might dap up a Blazers player who dunked on them?
Kevin Looney.
He's the new Chris Gatley.
Sadly,
there is definitely no Sean Kemp on the Blazers roster.
Yeah, really, size-wise, I'm like, I guess it's... Mo Harkless can throw it down every once in a while.
But it's not the same.
That's why it has to be CJ or Dame, though, right? Because Sean Kemp is Sean Kemp. It wasn't like, you know...
I'm mostly saying that Sean Kemp is arguably the greatest in-game dunker of all time.
Well, yes, I understand. But even if it was Desmond Mason or something, like, he's a great dunker, but Desmond Mason doesn't mean what Sean Kemp means.
True.
So,
and Sean Kemp means a lot to the city of Portland based on his 2-year run with
huge.
The Blazers.
That's the only stint that I recognize of Sean Kemp.
No, a lifelong Blazers fan.
So they have to steal one in Oakland,
and then win
those two,
and then win three at home and win the series in six. Boom. And they have their track record against the Blazers at home
against the Warriors at home.
Yeah, I'm sorry, against the Warriors at home has been pretty good lately. Three of the last the four times they've played in the last two seasons, the Blazers have won by 15 plus points at Moda Center.
Interesting.
Yeah, of course. Before that, the Warriors won five in a row, including three playoff games.
Aside from. The altitude is such an X factor for Denver, even though the fact that Blazers went into Denver and won two games, the altitude is still something to be reckoned with. And their home record, the Denver Nuggets had a better home record than the Warriors did this year, right?
That is correct.
However, I think the Warriors had maybe a slightly better road record than the Nuggets did.
Just a tad bit, yes.
I mean, they're not that... It's still the number one and the number two seed, right?
Yeah, but one of those is the Warriors and one of those is the Nuggets.
That's the difference. Is the big X factor for the Warriors is not the altitude. It's being the greatest basketball team of all time.
And I mean, the thing is, you know, this is a big step up in competition. So far, the Blazers have beaten, another thing I noted in the 5-on-5, the number 8 and number 9 teams in point differential during the regular season.
First of all, how dare you? The main thing to me is just really recognizing, like, CJ played amazing in games 6 and 7 and clearly can take on kind of a big weight from Dame as far as scoring goes in the series. And I think Dame will have, depending on how they're defending him, he'll get more open looks in the series than he did against Denver.
I think he'll be more successful in this series. I don't know if he'll necessarily get more open looks.
Yeah, I think matchup-wise, this is a slightly better matchup, aside from the Warriors being amazing, but just size-wise and personnel-wise. Like, the Blazers will be able to do a little bit more of what they want to do in this
series.
They're
more similar to the Blazers than the Nuggets are, which is a weird thing to say.
Dame's just exhaustion level is going to be huge here. Because if he's done, if there's nothing left in the tank, the Warriors will sweep.
Yeah. And I think... You know, maybe we won't necessarily see it early in the series, but I think as the series goes on, there's one day between games the rest of the way. You know, I think that's probably where the toll of just this entire postseason will start to wear on the Blazers.
Mm-hmm. By like game 6 of the finals?
Yeah. The Bucks indoor rafters will really benefit at that point.
It's honestly, like, when you think about it, it's a little bit more, this is weird to say, it's a little bit scarier to me imagining the Blazers playing either the Bucks or the Raptors, because it's just like
we know different challenge.
The Warriors, right?
Yeah, like, but the way you know the Warriors is that they won 8 of 9 playoff games.
But they've also beaten them a lot of times, right? Yes. The Warriors are a beast that the Blazers have seen a lot of times. They have very rarely seen anything like Giannis and that Bucks team, or even the Raptors, like what the difficulties that somebody like Kawhi Leonard presents. Like I feel more confident about the Blazers playing the Warriors without KD than I would about them playing either the Bucks or the Raptors.
I guess I probably agree with that. Although the thing we should mention is that the Warriors without KD just basically never lose when he doesn't play. All those games that the Blazers won easily.
That's why I'm wearing the KD jersey. There we go.
All the games the Blazers won easily in Portland against the Warriors, KD had huge games in almost all of those. And when he plays well, they don't tend to play that well. And when he doesn't play, they tend to be amazing. I mean,
4D chess.
I don't know if they can necessarily count on the same Jordan Bell performance. Jordan Bell back in his college state.
No, Zach Collins is shutting him down.
Apparently, Jason Quick brought up in Game 6 that apparently Blazers fans were like, Jordan Bell was better than Zach Collins during his rookie season.
Okay.
I don't really particularly remember this being
a thing.
The worst
thing about it is that we can't watch it on freaking Comcast Sportsnet and hear Kevin Calabro commentate the games.
That's true.
Ugh, it's so much worse. Well, very much look forward to the series. Just hope that it's a close series.
I just hope both teams play well.
I mean that actually as a Blazers fan. I hope that it's a close series. Like, I hope that we get that the Blazers win a few games and make it competitive and feel like they have like a real shot at some point. I want this series to go at least 6.
Yeah. That would be an accomplishment for the Blazers.
What did you pick?
But by the way, I picked Warriors in 5. But we should mention at some point, this is the first time the Blazers have been in the conference finals in 19 years. I mean, you know that as a lifelong Blazers fan, of course. Yeah. You remember well the 2000 conference finals.
Robbed.
Game 7 against the Lakers. Should we talk about a place that I used now about a place that I used to go when I worked for the Sonics?
Wow, we talked about Blazers. When there's Blazers and Seahawks stuff, these podcasts are like 3 hours.
I don't think, hopefully it won't be
plus quite the that hidden long. Material at the end.
That will add a little bit. So today,
should there be any?
This week we were trying to go to Georgetown Deli for our search for Seattle's best sandwich. And I had been calling them a couple times to try to get to-go orders, which I usually do with that. It's kind of my like neighborhood sandwich place that I'll usually go after I've run. And it kept getting redirected to voicemail. And I just assumed there was something wrong with the number. Like maybe they had put the wrong number, had changed numbers and hadn't updated things. So I drove over there, drove down to Georgetown. And lo and behold, I looked in and there was nothing there.
Wow.
I mean, there were still some tables and stuff, but definitely no people. So they are permanently closed, sadly. The former Hitchcock Deli in Georgetown, which was home to, in my opinion, we haven't done the search yet, Seattle's best cookie. Not Seattle's best sandwich, but a very solid local sandwich. But sadly, that is no more. So instead, we had to pivot and go to a place that I used to eat frequently when I was working at the Sonics, the Elliott Bay Pizza Company and Flame Burger on the top of Queen Anne Hill. So it's been open since at least 1996, and it's weird because it's called Elliott Bay Pizza Company. There was also Flame Burger used to be a separate establishment down the street on Queen Anne Avenue North, and they had the same owner. And at some point, when there was an ownership change, they decided to merge those two into the same place.
Totally,
so now they've
makes
got
sense.
So it's Elliott Bay.
Elliott Bay Pizza Company and Flame Burger.
Which is known for its sub sandwiches.
And we went there for their sandwiches.
But that's
known for its sub sandwiches?
It is. I looked up a few reviews that, a few references in the news to Elliott Bay Pizza Company, like Seattle Times, Seattle PI, and they both mentioned, they talked about the subs and said, even though it's named at that point Elliott
Bay
Pizza
Company. Have you had the pizza?
Never.
Never. I had a slice of pizza today.
Did you?
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, let's talk about the other stuff.
Okay. I feel like at one point they may have had calzones, and that may have been a specialty, but I don't think they have those anymore.
If you have calzones, why do you ever get rid of calzones?
They really took a very long time for them to cook, I think. And also now they're cooking burgers and sandwiches and pizza. Like, there's a lot going on in the menu at Elliott Bay Pizza Company and Flame Burger. But my longtime standby has been the chicken cordon bleu sandwich. Mm-hmm. The bread is made in-house. This is one thing I learned from reading these reviews.
Interesting. And I would not have guessed that.
I would have guessed that because it achieves the perfect amount of crispiness and like softness on the inside, their bread.
I would say that the bread probably achieved that.
Maybe the strength of the entire sandwich is the bread.
Okay.
And the chicken cordon bleu comes with like sliced chicken, some slices of ham on the top, lettuce. There's a dressing on there.
Blue cheese.
Yeah. Tomatoes, onions. So it's strangely, I go with that over the chicken parm there.
Oh, wow. There were a lot of subs that kind of spoke to me on the menu.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I could have eaten basically any of them, which granted, that's partially just to say, I like eating sandwiches. But also,
that's why we're doing this.
I settled on the pizza sandwich.
Oh, did you?
Because I figured we're going to a pizza place. What do they, which clearly I didn't realize that they were also a burger place. Maybe I should have gotten the burger sub.
that's not a real thing.
What do they know better than pizza?
I guess that's
at a pizza establishment. So I got the pizza sub. Also, I don't know if you knew this. Pizza's great.
That is a true fact.
And great in sub form.
What comes on the pizza sub?
There's a salami, I think, a pepperoni, and then a ham.
Hmm.
And then like cheese and some like peppers and stuff. It was good. So I got this to go, stopped in, saw the slices that they have waiting. I can't believe you never got a slice. Just like a slice and a sub. I mean,
come on. Were you going with the 6-inch or the 12-inch?
I got the small one.
Yeah, so I always go with the 12-inch. So there's no room for additional pizza.
This was a large sandwich, in my opinion, the small one.
I mean, the 12-inch, I did not eat again all day.
I it would have been too much sandwich for me, though.
That's fair.
In a way. It's just like, I feel like the sandwich is very one note. You know what I mean? Like, you're not getting like a rich sort of different amount of flavors from it. It's basically just kind of like the one smashed together pizza flavor, which is good. It just wasn't like, there wasn't sort of the diversity of it. And so they had slices there. There was a cheese slice that I thought looked pretty good. And I would say, this is going to sound bad, I would compare it negatively to our grandparents' pizza.
Really?
Because our grandparents would make pizza sort of like handmade.
Not a specialty, by the way, of Genoa, the pizza.
Well, it's not like it was bad, right? The pizza that they would make, it would taste homemade.
Yeah.
Right? When you're raised on bullshit, like Pizza Hut, like.
Wow. What's your tone when you talk about Pizza Hut, good sir?
You understand what I'm saying, though.
Yeah.
When you're raised on fast food pizza, homemade pizza tastes different. It tastes homemade. And that's kind of what this pizza tasted like. Whereas when I have a place like Poliachi or something like that, that's not the way that it tastes to me. Nope. It tastes like a special, unique flavor. And so I had a slice. It was fine. I probably, if I went back, probably would not get a slice again. I would give the pizza slice like a 70, maybe a 75.
Okay.
And the sandwich to me, it was a good sandwich. Nowhere near a competitor for Seattle's best sandwich, in my opinion.
Nowhere near. I mean, so why didn't you do what I recommended, the chicken cordon bleu?
Because if I'm going to a pizza place, I'm going to get the pizza sandwich. It wouldn't have mattered, though. I can guarantee you that this chicken cordon bleu sandwich, no matter what it tasted like, is not. We're talking about an echelon, right?
I agree. I mean, I think that there's a tier of sandwiches that we're going to get to in this competition. And I would put Georgetown Deli, when it was Hitchcock, in this same tier. It's a good neighborhood sandwich.
Yeah.
Like, if I lived near there, I would go to Elliott Bay on a regular basis. And that's what I did when I worked in Queen Anne and then in Inner Bay with the storm. I looked it up, and I could not find record of going to there since 2014.
In your food records.
So it's been a while.
In your eating database.
I was looking at emails I sent to people about where we were going to eat lunch.
You looked at the extensive notes of every meal you've ever had.
I mean, I guessed beforehand that I do not actually keep that. It's only every beer I drink. You know that. I would have guessed before that I had not gone since I last worked for the storm. So I was actually kind of surprised how recent it was.
What year?
2014.
When did you last work for the storm?
2012.
12.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I mean, it's not a destination.
I wouldn't recommend against these sandwiches. I wouldn't say don't go there. It's not a destination sandwich. Totally agree.
Yeah,
it's a very solid neighborhood sandwich. I mean, like the reality is, it's a pizza place and a burger place and a sandwich place. Like if they made that good of sandwiches, I would be shocked. Right?
Again, they are known for their sandwiches. I give it an 89. I think that's a really, yeah.
Wow. I'm giving the sandwich. I'm giving it an 80.
Okay.
It's not bad. I'd eat it again. You know what place we have to go to, though? We haven't really explored the world of Philly cheesesteaks very much.
That is accurate, even though we've been to Tats, which is known for their Philly cheesesteaks. So where would you like to go?
Hold on. I need to look up the place. But it's right by you. Is it called King Philly Cheesesteaks? There's the one spot that's right, like hidden in like Georgetown area. I think it's King. No, that says it's in Brighton. Oh, Colozzi's Cheesesteaks.
That is it.
That is the spot that we've got to go to.
All right.
Is that even on our list?
It is not on our list, but we can put it on the list.
Right? Because a cheesesteak is a sandwich.
Yeah.
That, and I had it one time ever, and I ate it I think I ate it after driving from Georgetown back all the way to Renton, which is a pretty long drive. And it had gotten cold at that point, and it just like it wasn't as good as it could have been, but it was still pretty excellent. 4.5 stars on Yelp. Also, it's just like, I mean, you know, freaking Colozzi's cheesesteaks, right? Like, yeah. This is what we're looking for right here.
I tomorrow am going to be going. I don't know when you're going to get the chance to go to this, so we might not review it for a while. But Grinder's Hot Sands Restaurant.
Where is
in
that?
Shoreline. Yes, I happen to be
Tell
going
me
up.
More.
Happen to be going up to Shoreline for an interview. So conveniently, I will be doing lunch
so
there.
Bad. Look at all that cheese and look at all that steak.
I don't. I'm still very full from the 12-inch sandwich I ate for lunch 9.5 hours ago. But so we'll be getting to both of those spots. But
when
Colossus
did I say
next
that
week.
Something was too much meat for me?
It wasn't Tats.
It definitely was not Tats. I just don't like a lot of like dry meat. You know what I mean?
I do understand what you're saying.
I don't like a
there.
Stack of dry meat. But like if you give me a cheesesteak where there's cheese mixed in with all the meat, peppers and onions and stuff like that, like come on. I'm ready to eat this right this second. Anyway, so we should be going here, and neither of these cheesesteak places are on your list, right?
King Philly
Cheesesteak,
yes.
Or Colozzi's.
No, neither of them are on there.
I feel like those are the two that we need to go to.
Okay. We can do them.
Hell yeah.
I miss the standby, again, in the Sonics days for Philly Cheesesteaks was Philly Fever out on Madison Street, but that sadly is no more.
You're going to Grinders?
Yes.
Number 9? What is the one that's in Wallingford?
Valhalla?
I thought that was Grinders. Oh, is that Valhalla?
No, Valhalla is in North Ballard.
I thought
Ballard.
That was Grinders.
I don't know if there's any. I don't know which.
Somebody out there is screaming in their head about this right now.
It's always the best part of the podcast.
Royal Grinders in Fremont, not Wallingford. Sorry.
Ah, yes.
And that's on our list, right?
That is on our list. Yes.
Okay.
I did not realize that we had both Grinders and Royal Grinders.
Okay, so you're going to Grinders in Shoreline this week.
Yes.
All right, I can get there. Can you get to Colozzi's Cheesesteaks by next week? You can go on Monday.
No, I can't go on Monday. I'm going to Portland for game 4. But I can go on Tuesday before we record the podcast.
There we go.
Week. It's always very good to discuss our itinerary, our full schedule on the
Blazers
podcast.
Win in a cheesesteak? There couldn't be anything better.
Should we talk about Seattle sports?
All right. I'm really fired up about cheesesteaks right now, I have to say. I want to eat that cheesesteak right now.
I'm so not ready to eat a cheesesteak.
The problem with this podcast is that I don't do enough eating cheesesteaks while we're recording it.
I feel like it'd be difficult to hear you then. NHL Seattle news. The NHL Seattle group launched a fan portal, SeattleNHLFans.com. And on there, an FAQ that offers a few insights on timetable for some of what's to come for the NHL Seattle group. It says, ticket prices will be announced this fall when fans will be able to select their seats and the team name, quote, potentially this fall. I also thought this was interesting from the FAQ. List capacity at the new arena at Seattle Center for hockey is 17,300 and 18,600 for concerts. No mention of capacity for basketball.
Here's your capacity for basketball right here.
Oh, it's more of bird good.
Let me just say I'm giving a Michael Porter-like gesture.
Yeah. I have to assume this is just an oversight because we know they're playing basketball games there. The Seattle Storm is going to play at this arena. Why you wouldn't mention that? It's just a bad look for a group that doesn't need a bad look with basketball fans.
If there are any out there.
There are some of us. There are a few of us.
Well, I mean, if I have to defend them, which I don't, but I would say that for the Storm, it would be hard to list the capacity for basketball because you don't know what you're going to open.
I mean, yeah. They may list a sellout as much
probably the
number.
Same as hockey. Like, are they adding seats?
Because hockey, you have fewer seats because there's no courtside seats in hockey. The hockey rink is larger than a basketball court.
Okay.
But it's somewhere between those two numbers.
For the Storm.
I mean, the full capacity for basketball will probably be somewhere around 18,000, I would guess, based on those two numbers.
There we go. We're selling it out for the Storm every game.
I would that we did. All right, it's time for your favorite segment. Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at ya.
You remember earlier this season when you were commenting about how weird it was that there wasn't a Mariners game on a Friday, that they had a random Friday off?
I do recall that.
Well, something weird happened this week. And they took the entire week off.
Huh.
None of the days did the Mariners play a game this week. On Thursday night, so much good stuff happened in sports. CJ McCollum had a monster game to extend that playoff series to Game 7. The Mariners game was canceled.
This is like Super Bowl 49 was canceled.
On Saturday, Felix Hernandez struck out his 2,500th batter. And still the game was canceled.
Weird.
Somehow. Sunday, Mother's Day, it was beautiful. They had to cancel the game. Every single day of this week, the Mariners somehow managed to not play. It was an impressive feat for them. Similar to Super Bowl 49, this team went out there and did not play.
Well, kudos to the Mariners. We'll see if they return to action this week, but I kind of doubt it. By the way, there's only his 2,500th career strikeout.
That's what I was trying to say.
He's at 22,500, which means so many career strikeouts.
I was trying to say, it's hard to say 2,500, something like that. Just delete that part.
We're definitely not going to delete that. Anything else on the Mariners? They keep playing baseball.
Do you have anything else on the Mariners? You know what the real take is here, though? The entire sport of baseball took the week off. Like, who's thinking about baseball for this last week?
That's a good question.
Nevertheless, they continue to somehow play games.
I was thinking about the Sounders, who got a 1-0 win on Saturday against the Houston Dynamo, their first win since April 13th, having gone 0-1-3 in that span with three draws out of four matches. The only goal in this game, another golazo from Christian Roldan, who scored from outside the box in the early minutes. Again, a pretty even match in terms of expected goals between these two teams. Sounders had the first Real Ruy Diaz start since March 30th.
Still undefeated with Ruy Diaz in the lineup.
That is true. Chad Marshall out again with knee inflammation, and Gustav Svensson missed his third consecutive match with a hamstring strain. Not great news that those players continue to deal with injuries before a more crowded fixture schedule this week. On Wednesday, the Sounders will host Orlando City SC at 7:30 p.m. Orlando City comes in 10th in the East with 12 points, although their goal differential is a respectable -3. Nani leads the team with 5 goals and 4 assists, with longtime Sounders nemesis Dom Dwyer second on the team with 3 goals. And then on Saturday, the Sounders will travel, start an extended road trip here that includes some international breaks at Philadelphia at 4:30 p.m. on Saturday. The Union leads the East with 23 points, have gone 5-1-0 so far at home, with their lone loss coming to Toronto FC on opening day. Philadelphia winning on the strength of their defense. They have the fourth lowest expected goals allowed per 90 minutes this season, according to American Soccer Analysis.
I always imagine Dom Dwyer in my head as being the star of HBO's Looking.
Oh, that's funny because I imagined him to be the Dom from Entourage. The short-lived Dom.
Both HBO characters. Yeah. Wildly different.
Totally different.
The real Dom Dwyer is probably some sort of combination of that. I'm sure his mustache is immaculate.
Dom Dwyer, long time at Sporting KC, and then traded to Orlando City a couple years ago now. The significant other of one-time Seattle Reign star, Sidney LaRue.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. There you go. Speaking of Reign FC, after the weekend off, they will host...
What a transition.
Sky Blue FC on Saturday. Sky Blue, one of the two teams behind the Sounders in the standings at 0-3-2 so far, so definite opportunity for the Reign to make up some ground in the standings, playing at home against them. The Seattle Storm opened the preseason on Wednesday at Angel of the Winds Casino Arena in Everett versus the Phoenix Mercury, their first game up in Everett, and then travel to Pasadena on Friday to face the LA Sparks in their second and final exhibition game. Alicia Clark and Sammy Whitcomb, whose teams are playing each other in the French finals, the last two players yet to report to training camp. Those two teams play game three of their series on Tuesday, with Clark's team going for the sweep that would get both players back to Seattle. Storm coach Dan Hughes gave the commencement address on Saturday at his alma mater, Muskingum College in Ohio.
Israel College. I wish that you wouldn't have listed where that was so I could have guessed.
Oh, that would have been a great call. Podcast geography.
I have literally never heard... Have you ever heard of that college before?
I mean, I've probably seen it on his bio before, but...
Muskingum College?
It's not a very large... They said the graduating class was, I think, 370. I think I read one of the stories. Or 320.
Wow.
Not a lot of people there.
I feel like Dan Hughes probably is the only professional basketball coach to come out of there.
You gotta have to assume that.
It's like...
The Storm have...
Who would be like, there's always like one like NBA legend coach who came from every small college.
I don't know if that's true.
I'm trying to think. It'd be like Hubie Brown actually went to Muskingum College. You had no idea.
Yeah. I'll have to look up the Wikipedia page. But while I'm doing that, Brian Egler went to Wittenberg University. Wow. Former Storm coach.
Wittenberg?
Do you know what state Wittenberg is in?
I'm gonna say Oregon, but I'm probably just thinking of Whitman.
Yeah, that is definitely not. It's definitely not in Oregon.
I'm going to go ahead and play the odds and say it's in Massachusetts.
Nope.
Okay. Indiana.
Nope.
Ohio.
It is Ohio.
There we go.
They actually, I think, played each other at one point.
Wow.
In college.
Did you know that Bob Hill actually graduated from Wittenberg?
Oh, you know who went to Muskingum?
No, I can't.
They only list one alumni on the actual page. There is a separate list. It is not. It is not, sadly.
Oh my
god! Oh man, there's actually a couple of notable.
Yeah,
alumni.
Three or four presidents went to Muskingum.
Well, one president, Warren G. Harding,
oh, of course,
went to Ohio Central College, which later became part of Muskingum.
Everybody knows the Muskingum lore. Okay, so who went there that you were talking about?
The most notable, the one person that they list on the actual Wikipedia page is the astronaut John Glenn.
Wow. There we go. I thought you were going to be like Sufjan Stevens.
Sadly, no.
Okay.
The Wikipedia page does not list Dan Hughes as a notable alumni and does not list, or no, they do list a few people in
sports.
Sounds
like you have work to do.
That's true. Including an umpire.
Umpire. You cheer for him. Oh, big fan.
Not a neutral in baseball.
I mean, you kind of are.
Well, yes, I guess so. Is that I do not care about all the teams equally. Coach Hughes, heading back to Seattle after giving that commencement speech to prepare for cancer surgery coming up soon. So, again, thoughts and prayers with him going into that. On to UW. Husky softball swept Stanford by a combined 16-2 final score over the weekend. Well, UCLA dropped 2-3 to Arizona, who the Huskies had just swept on the road, to produce a tie atop the Pac-12.
There we go.
As we mentioned earlier, the fourth conference championship for the Huskies in program history.
So the season's over?
The regular season's over,
wow.
Yes.
All right.
Pac-12 awards came out this week. Shortstop Sis Bates was named the Pac-12 Defensive Player of the Year. So this weekend was also the seeding for the NCAA tournament. The Huskies earned the number 3 overall seed and will host regionals this weekend against Fordham, their opening opponent, Mississippi State, and Seattle University, which is making its first ever NCAA tournament appearance. The Huskies beat Mississippi State 7-5 in Puerto Vallarta College Challenge earlier this season in Seattle. You won nothing in the Husky class.
What do you? This is this weekend?
Yep.
At the Husky softball stadium?
Yep.
You think tickets are sold out for that?
Probably not.
What do you think tickets cost for something like that?
I looked. I think the single game tickets run like $10 to $20.
All right.
So, or single day, because there are multiple games per day. So looking way ahead of the bracket.
I might try to go to those games.
Yeah. Looking way ahead, if the bracket holds, the Huskies would host number 14 Kentucky in the Super Regionals next the following weekend.
Also in Seattle?
Yes. And then if they get to the world, if they both get to the Women's College World Series, they would face Arizona, the number 6 seed, in the opening game in Oklahoma City. Three Pac-12 teams among the top 8 seeds. UCLA got the number 2 seed. The defending champion Oklahoma's not the defending champion, is they? Are they?
This is Pelton Cast memory.
I know, I'm trying to remember who beat the Huskies in the championship series.
I think it was Oklahoma.
Okay, yeah. They are the number 1 overall seed this year.
I remember watching that and being devastated.
Well, I remember being upset that they always get to host the... It's always in Oklahoma City.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah. It's a really unfair advantage for them, if you think about it.
Being the number 1 overall seed and hosting just doesn't feel right.
No, it was Florida State that won last year. Huskies beat Oklahoma.
Florida State. So we beat Oklahoma in their house.
Yeah.
And then lost to Florida State in the best of 3 final.
Yep.
I remember there was one game where they lost like 1-0 because of a homer.
That is correct, yes. They lost the opening game of the championship series. 1-0. And then lost 8-3 in the second game. UW men's basketball, Matisse Thybulle decided to pass on an invite to this week's NBA draft combine, which I'll be covering in Chicago.
Who's going? Finish this and then answer my question.
He was invited, but we decided to pass, agent Eric Goodwin told Percy Allen. We believe Matisse brings a unique basketball skill set to an NBA team, and our focus will be on organizations that are interested and we believe are a good fit. Which is weird because it seems like always that would be your focus, but you know.
So who goes to the NBA Combine? Is Zion going?
He definitely won't like participate in the games, which may have been a factor in Matisse's decision, but most everyone is going.
Ja and Cam Reddish are going.
I think the only higher rated college recruit, like there are some internationals that obviously are busy playing and aren't there, but the only higher rated college recruit who's not there than Thybulle is actually Rui Hachimura from Gonzaga.
Oh. Why wouldn't you participate? What does this mean?
I mean, the immediate scuttle is I retweeted from my ESPN colleague, Jonathan Gavoni, who focuses on the draft, is that he has a promise from a team. So therefore, you know, that's why you would kind of shut down everything.
And we know who the team is that he's promised to.
We don't know who the team is that he's promised to, or if there even is a promise. But my mind immediately went to Oklahoma City, which has a reputation for promising players. Or a track record, I should say. Thybulle also continues to be.
I gave another Michael Porter salute there to the situation because we know what's going down, right?
Thybulle also has been linked prominently to the Philadelphia 76ers, a team that is in need of 3-and-D help after losing to Toronto in Game 7 yesterday.
Good history with drafting Husky players.
Yes, definitely want to go back to that. Well,
so, but honestly, like. Oklahoma City of all teams makes so much sense.
If they need an Andre Roberson replacement, if they don't think he's going to make it back.
If they want a player who can't shoot, who can play defense and can't shoot threes.
I hope that Matisse Thybulle is a better shooter in the NBA than Andre Roberson.
Matisse probably will become a pretty good three-point shooter, but just something about his game feels very Sam Presti to me.
Yep.
I mean, you look at the players that they have, but also they have like 3 Matisse Thybulles already.
That is also fair.
Right? Like what is the, I can't even remember their perimeter players.
Terrence
name.
Ferguson.
Yeah. And the other guy.
Hamidou Diallo.
No, not him. Who's the other one that starts?
Paul George. you think of Jeremy Grant?
Yeah, Jeremy Grant.
I mean, Jeremy Grant's a power forward center, so I would not,
he's not
compare.
That big.
I mean, he's 6'8".
How tall is Matisse? 6'5".
Yeah.
But Terrence Ferguson, I guess, at the very least, is like, if you want to give a like neutral Matisse Thybulle comp in the NBA, it's probably Terrence Ferguson.
Yeah.
It's like average scenario for Matisse.
Yeah, it's probably the case.
Best case scenario is he becomes a superstar like Andre Roberson.
I think Matisse Thybulle might be older than Terrence Ferguson. Who spent a year playing in Australia before getting drafted at age 19. So
really?
Yeah.
I was wondering where Terrence Ferguson came from. He was
an Arizona commit, but did not end up playing there.
He just feels like the type of player that Oklahoma City really likes.
All right, the other update. So Jalen Noel will be at the combine. Again, we'll have an update on how
you're
going to
be there booing him.
No, I have nothing. Look, I want Jalen Noel to succeed. I'm just a little skeptical of the chances of that happening. The other UW basketball news, the Pac-12, we actually didn't mention this happened before last week's podcast, but the Pac-12 has voted to move to a 20-game conference season starting in 2020-21, which will mean conference games, they'll play, I think, two of them in November and December. This parallels a move by the Big Ten to start doing this the last couple of years with an eye towards improving the strength of schedule and the net rating for teams in the conference because they'll play fewer non-conference games.
So basically they're replacing... The idea is that you replace games against poor quality teams with supposedly higher quality teams.
Yeah, I mean, hypothetically. In the Big Ten, that was the case. In the Pac-12, maybe not.
Why don't you just do 22 games and let everybody play everybody twice?
I don't know.
Like, why 20? Where does that number come from? It's even?
It's what the Big Ten did. I mean, I didn't.
The Big Ten doesn't even know how many teams are in the conference.
That is an accurate statement about the Big Ten. So. I mean, they do know, but it's just not reflected in the name of the conference, nor is it in the Big 12's case. It's very confusing.
It really feels like 22 is the right number here, though. If this is going to be the case.
I do agree. I mean, the double round robin is the way that God intended college basketball conferences to play. Oh, that broke you.
Just the idea that...
There was a commandment that came down on the stone tablet.
The double round robin.
Thou shalt play a double round robin.
Well, just like... But it's all, I mean, play all the teams one time at home and one time on the road. It's pretty obvious.
The EPL figured this out.
Let me just
say. I assume most soccer leagues that are not the MLS.
God is not paying attention to MLS. College basketball. And in particular, the Pac-12.
Oh, no.
the Pac-12 is a godless league.
God forsaken. Oh, boy. All right, well, let's wrap things up by getting a little emotional because it's time to pour one at it, even though I don't have any left. The Seahawks
got a little bit of sour beer here, which feels right. No, this is a happy thing.
The Seahawks announced that they have waived Doug Baldwin and Cam Chancellor, both with failed physical designation. Obviously, no surprise here with the reports about Baldwin around the draft, and he seemed to confirm his retirement on Sunday by posting an extended series of tweets that concluded with posting the "My Watch Has Ended" gif from Game of Thrones.
I'll explain to you later.
No, I have no idea the context of that. I just know it's from there. Baldwin finishes his Seahawks career third in catches, third in receiving yards, and second with 49 touchdowns behind Steve Largent. Brian Blades, the other receiver, is added in the other two categories.
Huh.
Yeah. You had a big-time career. He's a little before your time. Not a lot, but a little. Emotions.
Freaking Doug Baldwin.
I discouraged you from doing the Doug Baldwin obituary.
And now you want to do an hour three of this podcast?
Yeah.
Just
now it's time.
Doug Baldwin, of all players. It was so fast. Right?
It was too fast.
It wasn't like we saw it coming for a long time. It was just like, over the draft, all of a sudden, it's like, Doug Baldwin's retiring. And
I mean, obviously, we knew he had the injuries, but it wasn't like, oh, he's not going to be able to play at all or ever again.
Man, I think this might be kind of a brutal sport.
I also think so.
I just feel like... Doug Baldwin is never my favorite Seahawk, right? But not because of anything Doug Baldwin did, right? He's pretty much, for all intents and purposes, the perfect Seahawk to sort of describe this era of Seahawks football, right? Like, more so even than, like, Richard Sherman. Like, we already eulogized Richard Sherman's career with the Seahawks. But Doug Baldwin is somebody who, and Sherman did work in the community and stuff like that, but is somebody who is... He was a 6th round pick or undrafted.
Yeah.
Doug was undrafted. Sherman was a sixth round pick.
Yes.
Undrafted receiver.
Why do you think he was so angry?
Undrafted receiver who kind of built his way up on this team to being an elite level wide receiver. Somebody who, if he'd continue playing, would probably sniff the Hall of Fame. Probably not, because the Seahawks will never pass the ball again. But who already, in not that many seasons, is third in a lot of statistical categories for the Seahawks. Somebody who will be in the Ring of Honor, right?
For sure.
A very notable Seahawk. But also, aside from that, wasn't particularly outspoken. Wasn't somebody who, like Richard Sherman.
At the start of his career?
Or something like that, right? He wasn't Richard Sherman, but he was somebody who was so prominent in the community, maybe more so than almost anybody else, right?
I mean, right near your old house.
There's a freaking Doug Baldwin Community Center going up in the city of Renton.
It's under construction?
No, I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if that's actually happening, but at the very least, pledged to, right? There's footage that I'm watching of him.
Including by you, the listener, purchasing tickets to our last live show.
There we go. Of him at Renton Stadium, right there near the practice facility, working with young kids in the community. And this is something that I'm not seeing from other Seahawks. Like, we didn't really see with Sherman, right? I mean, we see it with Russell and his work at Children's Hospital. But like, aside from that, like, Doug is such an important fixture in the community and somebody who has, even somehow more so than a player like Sherman or a player like Cam Chancellor, he was undrafted and became the number one receiver, right?
I mean, to me, Doug Baldwin was like an immediate favorite because I've always had a soft spot for kind of the undersized slot receivers. Bobby Engram. Back in his Seahawks days.
Doug Baldwin was that, but he was also a number one receiver.
Yeah, then he transcended that. Yeah. I mean, he became so much more than that. I mean, you know, if we want to transition to talking about Doug Baldwin memories, I mean, the second half of the 2015 season when the Seahawks offense went to a level that it has never, ever gotten to. And, you know, who knows when it's going to get back there again. But the combination... The Russell Wilson-Doug Baldwin combination during that season, he led the NFL in touchdowns. I mean, the amazing catch against Minnesota in the playoff game. Like, it was an incredible run that year.
Doug Baldwin somehow was always open, right?
Oh, I mean, his technique as a route runner, like, it's so much fun to watch.
Both an amazing route runner and somebody who, in sort of like the Russell Wilson, like, you know, playground style or whatever, when he broke the pocket, yep, would manage to find a way to get open. There's no receiver like that.
I mean, you always think of, you know, the problems that it created anytime a team tried to cover zero blitz the Seahawks with Russell Wilson and Doug Baldwin. It was like a guaranteed touchdown because he was always going to win off the line.
Doug Baldwin's so good. He was a number one receiver who also didn't create problems either. Like, so unique as it, when we see this offseason with like Antonio Brown, right? Like, wide receivers eventually are upset with how much they're targeted, and Doug Baldwin really never became that. The only time
he was sometimes upset about it, but it was short lived.
The only maybe a little bit fiery, but there was one time that he
again, his nickname is Angry Doug Baldwin.
He yelled at Tom Cable also. Doug Baldwin is all of us.
Ultimately supportive of the offensive coaches. You'll note that in his Twitter thread leading up to the retirement announcement that when he talked about the coaching staff, it was not a photo of Pete Carroll. It was a photo of Daryl Bevel.
There we go. He knows who the real hero from this era is.
By the way, Antonio Brown, the only player in 2015 with more receiving DR, according to Football Outsiders, than Doug Baldwin, when he was number one by a wide margin in DVOA.
Doug Baldwin is so good.
Yeah. Any other Doug Baldwin memories?
It just sucks. He's going to be really hard to replace. And he's also, I mean, this was one where it's like, you really go down the names of kind of like who the Seahawks were, right? And you're like, okay, the Legion of Boom, everybody's gone.
Yep.
There's not a single member left of sort of the initial Legion of Boom. And you're like, okay, like the D-line.
Or even the secondary Legion of Boom. Byron Maxwell's gone too.
This is the secondary Legion of Boom.
To me, Maxwell is the secondary. Maxwell and Jeremy Lin.
But that's just a couple players, right? Like, the whole thing. So, okay, you look at the defensive line. Bennett's gone. Averill's gone. Brandon Mebane's gone, right? You look on offense, and you're like Marchand's gone, right? Now Doug is gone. The only players who really remain, which it doesn't feel like it was that long ago, which partially...
No.
We're old.
But we're not even that old. I mean, this is, you know...
Oh, we are that old.
I mean, this happened on Thursday, and I was spending... after that game six win for the Blazers, was hanging out in the media room, drinking the free beer, eating the charcuterie.
Uh-huh. And, ruining the day. Hating the Blazers every moment of it.
And on they had ESPN on the TV, it had SportsCenter, and the graphic they were showing was the starting lineups from, I think it was Super Bowl 49, which is weird because it got canceled. But and from that game, the only players left are
Russ
Wilson
and Bobby Wagner.
No, there's KJ Wright.
Oh, KJ.
And then one of the offensive linemen, Justin Britt, okay, then. May have started that game.
But yeah, I mean, you really think
it's
about
four
it,
it's players,
kind of like the emotional core of that team, right?
Yeah.
All these players that we did the math in what didn't feel like that long ago when the Seahawks were winning Super Bowl 48, being like, this team, like that was Russell Wilson's second season.
That is correct.
You're like, okay, we have this super young quarterback and all of these young players around him, right? And you're doing the math and you're like, okay, we can't pay everybody, but this team should probably win four Super Bowls or so.
I never said force him. What happened to being pessimistic about your team?
I was just looking at it reasonably.
That was my pessimistic.
And yeah, I didn't get up to six. But you look at like how young those players were, right? And there, I mean, it really is just kind of to show how unique of a sport football is and how quickly it can all go away, right?
Yep.
And how you're like, okay, like Sherm's young, Cam's pretty young, you know, Bobby's still pretty young, Doug Baldwin's not that old, Thomas Rawls is going to be a monster forever. This was not that season, but a couple of seasons later. All of these players, and now in one off season, you have Cam Chancellor's official, even though he was retired last year,
yeah,
is officially retired more or less. Doug Baldwin is retired. Marshawn Lynch is retired in that same season. And really what this team is left with from that core is Russell Wilson, and who we knew, who's now locked up forever, who we knew would be sort of the face of the Seahawks and who will still be the face of the Seahawks for at least the next decade.
I don't know if I would say decade, but the foreseeable future.
It's and that's the way it is. It's the quarterback who remains, and then everybody else is going to come and go, and we're now entering into, for real, the second generation of the Russell Wilson era. Because it's not even the Pete and John era anymore. Like, they happen to still be here that entire time, but Russell Wilson likely will outlast those coaches and personnel.
Yeah.
And it's like, when you look at Pittsburgh or something, right? They won the Super Bowl against the Seahawks in Ben Roethlisberger's first year? Was that his rookie season?
No, it was his second year.
His first year
they lost to the Colts.
And it's like, from then, there's nobody left, obviously, because that was so long ago, even coaches. And it's like Ben Roethlisberger still remains. We're talking about a long time now. And it's like there's this generation and this generation and this generation. The first generation of those players is now more or less gone.
Yep.
And we have to hope that with this offseason that the Seahawks are kind of building up the second generation. Still love those historical players. Still love every single person who is there. But have to really hope that this team can sort of rebuild it up with the players that they brought in. And this offseason in particular feels like the offseason they've really started doing that.
And they've also prepared for, you know, continuing to do that, because it was reconfirmed, I would say, by the last week that their strategy this offseason was heavily based on accumulating 2020 comp picks. Because as soon as the comp pick deadline passed last week, just after we recorded our podcast, or maybe while we were recording our podcast, the Seahawks went wild with signing veteran players. They also had a little more cap space to do it. They saved $6.9 million on the 2019 cap by waiving Doug Baldwin and $2.3 million by waiving Chancellor. So their signings, first off, Ezekiel Ziggy Ansah, we talked about that possibility last week. We liked it a lot. He ended up signing a one-year contract with $6 million guaranteed, a $9 million base, and a max of either $13 or $13.5 million with incentives. The challenge here is to determine, is this a bargain or is he actually more hurt than we thought?
Doesn't matter.
I think it does matter.
For the... On the field, it might matter. as far as his contract goes, doesn't matter. What a freaking deal.
I mean, I fully endorse it. And, you know, especially to time it so you don't give up a comp pick for him. But if he does play well and you're unable to re-sign him next year, then you get a comp pick for him in 2021. Like, that's a great way to play things.
I mean, there's just nothing to like about the Ziggy, or nothing to not like about the Ziggy Ansah signing.
I mean, the shoulder injury is still a thing to not like about it.
But you got him as a bargain. How much was he paid last year? $18 million?
17.3, I think, on the franchise tag.
$17 million, and now he's signing for 6 to maybe 9, and if he plays well, 13, right?
And if he does that, then presumably he will have been healthy the entire season and completely worth it.
And probably on the field playing not that much necessarily worse than somebody like Frank Clark.
Yep.
Where you get both the long-term flexibility of not having to re-sign a player at a massive number, plus all of the draft picks that they got from that. It's like, this is the perfect situation for the Seahawks. This, to me, like, they have handled this offseason. We'll go through the other players that they signed in a second. This offseason, they have handled things so perfectly, and it's just like, where were these human beings last year?
That's a good question.
No, I mean, obviously, it's reactionary. Like, they recognize the failures, and that's what I like to see. I want to have a coaching staff that says, you know what, we fucked up in the past, and so we're going to do it better the next time. They're going to learn from their mistakes. We want coaches who have a growth-based mindset.
We want coaches
at 79 years old.
Who's signed kickers for a lot of money.
That's the only decision this offseason where you're like, I don't know about that one, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can quibble with some individual draft picks, but yes, from a big picture standpoint, yes.
I personally am over. Okay, you talk about how you don't, this was one of the worst things you've ever said. You don't, what was it? You don't judge shots by whether they go in or not. You just judge from like a macro perspective.
Was Kawhi Leonard's a good shot?
I'm trying to think of what you said, or you're like, oh, I don't judge by outcome. I only judge by process, something like that.
I'm pretty sure I didn't say it like that.
But that's the only way that I judge draft picks now. Like, LJ Collier, I don't know if he's going to be good. You don't know if he's going to be good. There's no individual draft pick that almost any human being can judge.
So you just judge by whether they traded down?
I'm just judging by quantity. That's it.
Well, then they should trade down literally every time and just accumulate as many.
I mean, like,
the final seventh round.
There's obviously
possible.
Some sort of radius of like a combination of like where a player is drafted and quantity, but you just have to judge by quantity. Because I went back and looked at old drafts and players that people raved about or whatever. I see no correlation between, say, draft grade or whatever. You know, like people who do draft
grade. There is some correlation, but it's very modest.
The things that I saw were when there were a lot of players, I had heard of a couple of them. And most of the teams that were like lauded, just like, I've not heard of any of these people since then or whatever. They're a massive bust. There is some sort of correlation between draft grade and success.
I think so. I mean, I'm not sure about like the team level draft grade, but in terms of like where individual players are mocked in their success, there certainly is some correlation.
Where individual players are mocked.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, the rest of their signings. Defensive tackle Al Woods, the classic Seahawks run-stuffing defensive tackle at a position where they are limited
in
terms of
depth. Signing.
Just 4.5 career sacks in 111 games, 43 of them starts.
That's what they like to see.
He started all 16 games in 2017 for the Colts when he ranked 10th among defensive tackles by Pro Football Focus grading, but just 8 of 14 last year when he dropped to 109th out of 129. So a very... Jerry DePoto-esque signing, hoping for some regression to the mean. Woods played 2 games for the Seahawks in 2011.
Oh, it's huge. We definitely remember those games.
Yes. Fullback Nick Ballore is a converted linebacker who played first 7 seasons primarily on defense for the Jets 49ers, for whom he started 10 games, in 2016, and the Lions before Detroit moved him primarily to fullback last season. Also a longtime special teams contributor, and if he makes the roster, I think that's going to be the biggest reason.
So we've signed in or drafted a lot of players who are going to play on special teams.
Yes. Cornerback Jamar Taylor was an effective starter with Cleveland in 2016 and 2017. who split last season between Arizona and Denver, getting waived by the Cardinals in November. He will compete at nickel for the Seahawks, but ranked just 129th out of 131 qualifying players in PFF coverage grade last season, playing primarily at boundary corner.
True or false, Jamar Taylor will start a game for the Seahawks this year?
True or false, Jamar Taylor will make the final roster?
True.
False.
You don't think so?
I think this is a classic Seahawks sign a veteran, and then he doesn't even make the team.
He's not. This is not one of those players.
I mean,
this is more Justin Coleman to me than.
Justin Coleman wasn't this old.
How old is Jamar Taylor?
I mean, he was drafted in like 2012.
Oh, wow. Okay.
He's been around.
Quite a bit older.
Yeah. I mean, he was a very high draft pick out of Boise State.
Oh, nice.
Where he played for Coach Pete. 2013 actually was when he was drafted. Second round pick by the Dolphins. But
you didn't answer that true or false, by the way.
Well, I think it's false because I think he's going to get cut.
Okay.
I mean, he's not actually that old. I guess he will be 29 in September. But this is, to me, a case where the Seahawks, with quarterbacks in particular, it's tough for them to bring players in from other systems where they are established players. Coleman wasn't an established player yet, so that's why he's different. I mean, maybe the nickel is different from the boundary slots because you don't have as much need for the kick step that they like to use with their boundary corner.
I think Jamar Taylor will start a game for the Seahawks this year.
At nickel?
Yeah.
Okay.
Or otherwise. I'm not limiting myself to that. I'm taking all of the secondary.
Well, yeah, but I'm
fullback, whatever.
I'm saying that nickel isn't always necessarily a starting position. We're counting that.
Oh, of course we're counting nickel. No, I mean, this is 2019 all of all right, time.
I'm just saying.
God.
All right, and the last player, the veteran the Seahawks...
That's why they signed a fullback.
Yeah. The last veteran the Seahawks signed, guard Marcus Martin, who was a third-round pick by the 49ers in 2014, who started 14 games for them in 2015, but has seen action in just two regular season games since then, suffered a season-ending toe injury with the Cowboys during last year's preseason. Martin, a versatile lineman who also saw extensive action at center with the 49ers.
Did you mention Geno Smith?
Well, they haven't signed him yet.
Oh, okay.
We're going to get to him in a second. Any thoughts on Marcus Martin?
Tons.
Oh, yeah.
I've been scouting the tape.
Yeah. Really grinded that tape. All right, as you mentioned, quarterback Geno Smith is scheduled to visit the Seahawks Wednesday and appears likely to sign as a backup quarterback, according to reports, including it was first reported by Jordan Ronan of ESPN.com.
So I thought it was reported that it was done, and then it was reported that it was...
There were conflicting reports.
Okay.
Smith posted QBRs of 42.0 and 45.9 in his two seasons as starter with the Jets. Really struggled with interceptions, has thrown picks on 4.0% of his career passes, the fourth most of any player with at least 500 attempts since 2012, his first year in the league. He is also 55th of 59 players in that group of 58% completion percentage. But his 6.8 yards per attempt are respectable 41st, basically identical to Sam Bradford and just behind Case Keenum. Smith also ran for 600-plus yards those two seasons. He's thrown just 96 passes since 2014, including four last season as a backup to Phillip Rivers for the Chargers. He completed 65% of his passes for 7.6 yards per attempt during the 2018 preseason.
If he was Sam Bradford, he would have made $300 million.
So much money. So much money. My takeaway here is that Geno Smith reminds me a lot of T-Jack.
Yeah, I'm all in on this Geno Smith signing. I'm all in on all these signings.
You're all in on Nick Ballore?
Fired up about... I mean, these are all low-stake signings.
Yes.
Even the Ziggy Ansah signing is a low-stake signing, all things considered.
Yeah.
Especially with the amount of money that kind of was freed up over the last few weeks.
I mean, it really kind of makes you wonder, like, why did teams sign anyone at the start of free agency?
The
real galaxy brain play is you should never sign anyone. It should just wait for after this deadline in May. I feel like that's what baseball teams would do in this scenario.
Oh, they definitely would. I was going to say, I wonder if there's a collusion factor in that. But, like,
I don't know if there's a collusion.
When did comp picks become so important? Like, when did that become a thing that we were paying attention to?
Probably within the last 10 years.
Okay. There were comp picks before then.
I don't know. I can't find it quickly.
Like 3 hours of research.
It's only in the last few years people have been tracking this online and, you know, kind of understood what the formula is.
It's kind of an amazing thing for us to be paying attention to. Love being a modern sports fan. we really understand the process more and more and more. There's obviously a difference between those two tiers of players. Like the first tier of players, you know, are going to be contributors. These, the players that the Seahawks signed since the comp pick deadline, like, okay, we're looking at percentage chances of making the team, right? We're going to assume they sign Geno Smith. Ziggy Ansah is basically nearly 100%.
Yes.
Geno Smith is like, it would be, to me, it's pretty high.
95.
Okay, then Al Woods. I feel like Al Woods will probably make the team.
There's not a lot of depth at defensive tackle, so I would say like 85.
Nick Belor.
40.
Jamar Taylor's probably the same or lower.
I mean, the one thing about these players, because of their experience in the NFL, if they're on the opening day roster, their salary is guaranteed for the full year.
Mm-hmm.
So you sometimes see teams manage that by waiving these players at the end of the camp and then bringing them back in week two. But, you know, that definitely changes the equation a little bit, you know, for some of these players who are on the borderline.
But it's just like, think of how many players, new players in particular, are going to be in camp with the Seahawks this year. Like, yeah. It is going to be a massive amount when you're talking about having the 10 draft picks plus kind of all of these sort of like secondary free agent signings and a couple of other free agent signings. There are going to be a lot of new faces on this team. And to me, if you use sort of those, what we would consider like extra spots on the roster for training camp players, you can either sign undrafted free agents or you could go out and sign players like this or a combination of both. But like, this is pretty high level depth to have on your team.
Yeah.
In a Seahawks team that needs to rebuild depth in a lot of places. And like, all of these players plus all of these draft picks are going to be pushing every single player who was on the roster last year.
Geno Siski pushing Russell Wilson.
You understand what I'm saying?
I do.
There's going to be a high level of competition in the Seahawks training camp.
It will be interesting to see if the Seahawks sign a veteran wide receiver or if they just count on all the guys they drafted and brought in to fill those spots at wide receiver.
Like
Jermaine Kearse is still out there.
It seems like the Seahawks are going out of their way not to sign Jermaine Kearse.
I don't know if they're going out of their way not to sign him. It's not like they're signing a bunch of like similar players to Jermaine Kearse. But it does not seem like they're ready for
a lot of players who've caught passes to send their team to the Super Bowl. Anyway, I'm just so all in on the strategy of...
You're drinking that Seahawks Kool-Aid.
But this is not the Seahawks Kool-Aid from 2 years. Like, I'm drinking the Seahawks Kool-Aid with the idea of, like...
You're drinking the good process Kool-Aid?
Yeah, this is the process. This is the process that took us to a Super Bowl and back to another Super Bowl before it was canceled.
So you're going
to
say they're going to draft... You're saying they're going to draft another one of the greatest quarterbacks of all time in the third round?
We already have that quarterback! It's everybody else that we need to fill in. And that's what they're doing. I am just so all in on the Seahawks offseason. Drink the Kool-Aid or otherwise.
I got that.
This is how you do it. The competition that they're going to have in training camp is going to be huge. Like, predicting who's going to make the 53-man roster would be a very difficult thing to do at this point. Whereas in last year, around this time, you could have done a pretty good approximation. Am I wrong about that? What?
I don't know if that's actually true.
You don't know if your mom's actually true? I think that this, going into the 2019...
Happy belated Mother's Day to mom. We never got around to doing the podcast with her food takes that you promised as a gift.
I didn't promise that.
No, you didn't. I suggested it, I guess.
Floated it. She didn't seem that interested. Everybody out there wants to hear Jan's food takes. Anyway, what I'm saying is that I think that it would have been easier going into the 2018 season to sort of, at this very day, May whatever it is, could have probably done an easier job of predicting exactly what the Seahawks 53-man roster looked like as of week one, 2018. Than it will be to do week one of 2019, for better or worse.
I think that's probably hindsight bias. But again, I also like their
offseason. They did not have this many new players coming into camp last year, or at least this
many. Yeah, but they also had more players continuing on because they didn't lose as many massive free agents. That's why they need to go out and add depth, because they lost a ton of free agents.
This year?
Yes.
Who of these people is massive to you? Aside from physically, with Sebastian Janikowski.
Well, I mean, Frank Clark is not a free agent, okay, but he's a pretty massive loss.
Frank Clark.
Also, Earl Thomas, by the way.
Earl Thomas.
Pretty massive loss. I mean, and obviously, they don't need to replace him in the same way.
Technically, Cam Chancellor, but that is opening up a roster spot for somebody to compete for.
Well, I mean, he was not in the final 53. It it opens up a spot in the 90, but...
Is Brett Hundley massive to you? Is Mike Davis massive to you? Is Jer Sweezy, Shamar Stephan, Justin Coleman, Maurice Alexander? Like, I don't... Well, I do grant that they'd lost a Hall of Famer this offseason and another player who's at least a Ring of Honor level player. Like, they lost some big players. I'm not questioning that. But I'm talking about quantity, and that's how you build a football team. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe this is the wrong perspective to have. But to me, quantity of NFL caliber players is how you build a football team. Rather than saying, I don't believe in stars.
Okay. All right. On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.
You went on Mitch's podcast.
I did.
And then he tweeted about how much he liked you? Or was he just promoting it? And
he was promoting it.
He asked to come on the Peltoncast?
Well, so you clearly did not listen to the Mitch Infiltrated episode, because at the end he says, look, I don't know how you do it on the Fabulous Peltoncast. He loves emphasizing the fabulous and fabulous as opposed to this mediocre podcast, I think was his line. Because I haven't been invited on there, and I told him, standing invitation, to come on Doc and Taco Time.
What did he say about that?
To discuss the Chris Carson situation.
What did he say about...
Well, he didn't commit to coming on, so I don't know. People are going to have to tweet at Mitch to, you know, encourage him to come on Doc and Taco Time.
One of my coworkers went to Taco Time for the first time ever and asked me what to order.
He also asked... at Talking Taco Time.
Oh, did
there
he?
Was an extensive conversation about it tonight.
David Price?
Yeah.
What did Talking Taco Time recommend?
I mean, I was going to ask you if he actually asked you or if he just was counting on a scene on Twitter.
No, he asked me. He might have thought that I ran the Talking Taco Time Twitter.
Right.
Which you would not let me have the keys to that car.
Absolutely not. Under no circumstances. But you could go nuts with the...
Trader Bros.
Trader Bros, yeah. Still waiting for episode 2 of Trader Bros.
What did Talkin' Taco Time recommend?
Talkin' Taco Time recommended a crisp burrito and Mexi fries.
Okay.
Then Taco Time chimed in.
Oh, really?
Taco Time Northwest chimed in to recommend a Mexi platter.
No. Get the hell... Have you ever eaten Taco Time, Taco Time?
What do you
mean? No,
It includes a crisp burrito and Mexi fries. Now, it's probably not enough Mexi fries, in my opinion, unless you're customizing it, so you're getting Mexi fries in place of the salad.
No, I didn't know how expert level he wanted to go. I wasn't, because he wasn't ordering through the app, clearly. I said crisp chicken burrito is a must.
I said crisp burrito, preferably chicken.
Because it's the most unique item that they have. But then, I like that this turned into a Talkin' Taco Time.
As one does.
And this is the special edition of Talkin' Taco Time. And then I was like, get a soft taco and Mexi fries. Whatever, beef, chicken, whatever, soft taco.
I mean, the other thing I didn't know is I was preparing this because he told me I had 5 minutes. So, you know, I had to go fast. And it was 2 minutes after before I saw it. I didn't know whether there, you know, he was going to need a third item on top of the crisp burrito and the Mexi fries.
Well, you just want to do a sampling your first time going.
That's
somewhere.
A great point. That's true.
So I was like, get a crisp chicken burrito, get a beef soft taco or whatever, add corn salsa. I didn't tell him to do, and I was like, make sure you get a hot sauce. I didn't tell him to do the sub pico for
tomatoes. Again,
that's he has to build up to that.
But we also got a Mexi platter suggestion from friend of the pod, Wusang.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There is no other logical choice. Also, dine in and enjoy it on a nice plate.
Well, that I can agree with. About the Mexi platter is I would rather just get the three items that I want, though. Because what do you get on there? A salad? Just some shredded up lettuce? It's bullshit.
This is the exact opposite of your take when we were doing the menu madness bracket.
Look, let's be clear here. My takes are fluid.
Yeah, they are fluid. And then our co-host Chris at CStyles206 chimed
David
in.
Didn't realize how much action he would get on asking Taco Time what to get.
Oh, I'm sad I missed this. I would always suggest a soft taco, preferably chicken. Mexi fries, order them extra crispy so they're hot.
Oh, hello.
And then, of course, a crisp burrito. I like to go opposite meat of my soft taco for the crisp burrito, but the crisp chicken habanero is choice.
Oh, there we go.
And then at least one hot sauce per item and a side or two of ranch for the Mexi Fries and Crisp Burrito.
The side or two of ranch. I wasn't sure whether to suggest the ranch or not. I thought that might have just been like a little bit too much.
Okay.
But that's really interesting. So me and Chris basically recommended the exact same thing.
Well, you know, I tweeted at David to ask him how this went. I haven't gotten a reply yet. So we'll see.
I can read you some texts.
Oh, okay. There we go. Live on the air.
He says, so I went through that, and he says, they also, on top of that, got a fish taco and churros.
Okay, good call.
Initial reaction, crisp chicken burrito is great, but this beef taco is not a taco, it's a burrito.
That is
true. And I said, oh yeah, that's part of the experience. And he says, wow, I love that I didn't know that and was just surprised. And then he sent this little video, of his partner holding up the taco with a question mark, baffled about it being
actually a burrito,
a taco, but actually a burrito.
Yeah.
And like, look, you know, like the crisp chicken burritos, more or less a taquito, the Mexi fries, some would say pretty similar to tater tots.
Not us. Never us.
Heretics.
Maybe Taco Time International fans might say that.
Yes. I guess, what is in the Mexi platter? I can understand the Mexi platter choice.
Again, it's crisp taco, crisp burrito, Mexi fries.
They should let you sub the crisp taco for a soft taco. For like an extra like $3 or something. If they did that, that is the best item on the menu. Okay. Right? Because then you get everything you want. It's just like...
We'll pass that along.
We actually can. It's like one of few corporations that we could actually pass along messages to. Although there's starting to be more, and maybe this is the very, very end of the podcast, I'm assuming, even more very soon.
Huh. How about that?
Wow.